The availability of clean drinking water in the U.S. should be commonplace, but is it? A number of cities continue to have drinking water that may be impacted by contaminants and get little media coverage after the initial discovery. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is Green Sense, where we discuss possible solutions to key environmental issues. As part of our look at the EPA as it marks its 50th anniversary, we are exploring water challenges that plague cities. We're joined by Jeremy Orr, attorney with the Safe Water Initiative of the Natural Resource Defense Council. Welcome to Green Sense.
Oh, thanks for having me, Robert.
The NRDC is a nonprofit environmental advocacy group with over 3 million members. That's quite impressive. And a staff of around 700 that consists of lawyers, scientists, and policy experts. And water issues are often a balance between economic growth and environmental protection, pitting the U.S. EPA, industry, and the public against each other. Jeremy, where does the NRDC fit in?
All right, so NRDC has been around for 50 years this year, actually, celebrating the 50th anniversary. And one of our roles, our primary role, is to be an advocate for a clean environment and public health. And we fit into that space of really advocating for, in particular in my program, for clean, safe, accessible, water for all individuals.
So when you do that advocacy, is it against EPA? Is it against industry? Is it for the public? Or rules change depending on the issue?
Yeah, it's always in favor of public health and well-being. And sometimes, that means taking on EPA and regulations that may be harmful or lack thereof regulations that, could lead to harmful impacts on communities. And of course, that means taking on industry and utilities at the same time as well. Folks who are in charge of administering, water to the public and holding them accountable.
The environment's a complex issue, so let's start out looking at water issues in Chicago, where you're based. You testified recently in front of the city council about the dangers of lead in drinking water. This has not been a story that the major media has covered much. What are the dangers to human health and the environment due to lead drinking water?
Well, I think it's been coming up more and more over the last few years, in particular with the Flint water crisis, really pushing, lead in drinking water to the forefront. And as we know, lead is an irreversible neurotoxin that can cause, damage in many ways, in particular to vulnerable populations, children, infants, pregnant women, and I think it deals in the space of developmental hindrances, especially for young people and many other kind of shortcomings.
If we look at Yonkers, New York, 75% of schools have dangerous lead levels in drinking water. How does this get around the EPA's Clean Drinking Water Act?
Well, I think it's one thing to understand that, the Clean Water Act, is different from the Safe Drinking Water Act. So typically lead in drinking water is governed by the Safe Drinking Water Act, public water systems. However, majority of schools in America aren't covered by the Safe Drinking Water Act. So there is no real federal regulation on lead in drinking water that applies to schools. So that ends up falling to states to regulate lead in schools and in childcare facilities. And unfortunately, states have across America not really, done the best job in enforcing, lead in drinking water in school systems. And New York is, just one example of that, Yonkers, but then the state of New York as a whole, in which you've seen, I think the last numbers were 80-something% of schools had, at least one action level exceedance of lead at least one drinking fountain in their school. And it comes down to, states really needing to step up where the EPA is lacking in federal regulation and making sure that they're requiring testing and remediation.
What is NRDC's solution to the lead in the drinking water problem?
Well, I think, twofold. I think when we look at, in particular in schools, as we're talking about, we're really looking at pushing, states to adopt a model bill, that we're referring to as filter first, right, in which schools are would be required to implement filtration stations at drinking water, points in schools, and then, test the water. So to make sure the water's filtered before it's going to kids, and then you follow up with testing protocols to ensure that the water is health protective. And then from the standpoint of, of nationally, what we're advocating for around, lead in drinking water is really the replacement of all lead service lines, around the country. As we know, America's infrastructure is old, right, and crumbling, and much of that infrastructure, the drinking water infrastructure, is lead, right, and the one of the best things we can do is remove, lead service lines from, from our water systems to ensure that folks are getting, clean water. In addition, maybe drop the lead action levels, at the federal level, and other steps we've taken.
So your last recommendation sounds great, but it sounds costly. How would that get funded?
Yeah, I think it is costly. And I think one thing to keep in mind is at a time, the federal government actually did, account for 70% of state and local infrastructure funding over the years, right? And we're at a point now where the federal government has shifted money, elsewhere and put priorities elsewhere to where, federal funding for, infrastructure, in particular water infrastructure, is down to, 13% or less. So I think one of, is making a priority at the federal level to say, hey, our infrastructure is crumbling. We're going to commit, to increasing funding here. And I think it's also, creative ways for states to find revenue to fund it at the state and local level as well.
Another water crisis that we covered here on Green Sense is what happened with the algae bloom in the western part of Lake Erie that put the city of Toledo's water supply in jeopardy. Can you give us a quick background on the crisis itself?
Yeah, sure thing. So back in, summer, around August 2014, so we're coming up on about 6 years, there was a 3-day period in which the Toledo water system was shut down, out of commission. They were telling folks not to drink their water, right? People woke up one day in August to notification saying, do not drink your water, do not brush your teeth, do not use it to cook food, do not shower in it, don't do anything. And it turns out that these harmful algal blooms had developed in Lake Erie, which had been a problem decades ago, that they thought they eradicated and began to come back. And at this point, it boiled over to the point where, people weren't able to use their water. The water system in Toledo was contaminated. And this really came from, runoff, really agricultural runoff, in particular from phosphorus from fertilizer that's used in the ag industry in that area, in that region. And, one of the, things is, we've, often, looked at, like the Clean Water Act, which was, passed in the 70s and should be regulating these things. But, what we come to realize is that, Clean Water Act only covers, point source solution in that instance, pollution in that instance. And in this, non-point source kind of runoff situation where, these toxins aren't actually regulated, that are running off, whether it's from the farm, whether it's, fertilizer or actual feces from livestock or septic tanks leaking that aren't necessarily a point source, aren't regulated, and this phosphorus from this got into the river that Toledo sits off of, which goes into runs into Lake Erie, which feeds the Toledo water system and contaminated their water. And this is something that occurs essentially every year. These harmful algal blooms are popping up every year. You can set your watch to it, and it speaks to needing to regulate nutrients, land use, as well as just the point source regulation.
As you mentioned, 6 years ago, this happened. Now that water's safe to drink, but as the algal blooms return, it impacts the economy, especially things like sports fishing and tourism. We've been talking about the EPA turning 50 this year. And one of its early triumphs was the Clean Water Act, and Lake Erie was a seminal event. It was on fire at one time. It was so polluted. And the Clean Water Water Act adequately protecting the water in Lake Erie, or is there more that has to be done to keep the runoff from agricultural lands And it, should that be done through legislation, or should that be done by some new form of behavioral governance?
Yeah, and you're right. Right, the Clean Water Act has not been adequate in protecting, you know, the folks in Toledo, in particular, you know, Lake Erie and the recreational, you know, use of it. And that reason being is you know, as I mentioned, just it doesn't, you know, Clean Water Act doesn't regulate, you know, non-point source pollution, which means that there needs to be, as you know, refer, some other form of regulation. And a lot of times, you know, this agriculture runoff, which is really the primary cause of this, you know, is regulated through, you know, state or local land use and zoning policy and local regulations. But, you know, oftentimes what we find is, you know, the argument, you know, made by the agriculture industry is, you know, these restrictions on how we carry out business, you know, would be economically harmful. But the inverse of not regulating those toxins, in particular, some sort of nutrient regulation, be it coming from the federal level or local level, the, you know, the downside of that is if we don't regulate it, we end up with, you know, Lake Erie being polluted every year and folks not being able to recreate and use, you know, that lake for other, you know, things.
So let's talk a little bit about COVID-19. It's hard not to discuss anything without bringing that up. How has that impacted drinking water as a priority? Has it made it more urgent, or has it taken a back seat to the virus and all the other noise that we hear out in the media these days?
Yeah, you know, throughout my work in, you know, with the Safe Water Initiative within RDC, you know, in Illinois and Michigan and other places around the country, this crisis has really brought the need for clean, affordable access to drinking water to the forefront. You know, with all of these stay-home orders, you know, we know the number one thing that we could do at the beginning of this crisis, which we've been hearing throughout, is wash your hands, right? And we begin to realize, as we were telling, you know, folks to stay home and stay safe, is that there were, you know, many people all over the country who simply did not have access to water, you know, with their water being turned off or their water, you know, not being clean, you know, and that comes back to this idea of, you know, water should be clean, safe, and affordable. And what we've seen is this amplification of, you know, people really waking up to say, wow, if the one thing I can do, literally the life-saving mechanism, is something as simple as access to clean water, and there are people who don't have that access, there's something really wrong with the system here, and we need to fix that. So I think many people are waking up to this idea that, you know, water should be, you know, in some form or fashion, a human right. Like, nobody should have to go without it, and that we need access to it and need to find ways to make it accessible and affordable for all people.
As I mentioned, we've been covering the EPA turning 50, and we had an expert on last week, and they mentioned using a carrot and stick approach to regulate environmental behavior. And for the EPA to protect the environment, punish those who break regulations with the stick and reward those who follow them with the carrot. Do you think it's time for EPA and the whole regulatory scheme, which is based on polluter pays, to change so that maybe there's a more progressive way to motivate people to take environmental stewardship of the land?
Absolutely. You know, I have a colleague and close friend who's always said, you know, environmental protection is somewhat like the criminal justice system, right? Where if you have the resources, you know, if you have the money, if you have the access, you'll get access to justice, right? And if you don't, then, you know, tough break. And it's the same thing with, you know, environmental enforcement, right? And with EPA, you know, if you know, industry, who has the money, who's producing the jobs and pushing the economy, if they're, you know, if they're in violation, right, it's easy to turn the other cheek, or it's easy to give them, you know, a pass. But on the back end of that, what's happening is the communities that bear the brunt of environmental or lack of environmental enforcement, in particular low-income communities, communities of color, you know, we end up getting, you know, what's left over. And I think it's, you know, really past time for the EPA to look at, you know, instead of the carrot and rewarding folks who are doing what they're supposed to be doing to begin with, they need to step up. One, the idea that they're there to protect the public, there to protect the environment and not there to serve at the pleasure of industry, right? And that means really holding, industry violators and polluters accountable and centering public health and well-being. That's still their mission, right? It's still their written mission, but actually stepping up to do it in a meaningful way.
And as I mentioned earlier, it's usually industry, EPA, and the public that are sort of pitted against each other. Is there a way that we can create a system that makes that more harmonious, where people are, driven to cooperate on the environment? And especially nowadays, we're in 2020. There is so much technology that's proliferated every part of our life, but I'm not sure the agency has kept up with the pace of that technology and looked at being creative. So any thoughts on how you think they could be re-engineered to be competitive in the 20s?
Yeah, and I think at the center of that, which you mentioned, is, it's this, kind of nexus of, the regulator, the regulated, and then, the individuals, the communities who are impacted by it one way or another. And that voice from the impacted community is the piece that's often left out, the piece that's often diminished and least valued when environmental decisions are made. And that's where I think, the EPA and regulators could do a better job, right, in creating, a space in which community input for folks' own health and well-being is taken seriously, right? It's there at the table, and they're able to have a say in the regulations, and able to have a say in the decisions that are being made. And that has to be, as you mentioned, in concord, right, and in conversation with, all three, partners in that space. But they need to be given a equal a voice to do so, and that needs to be intentional on the part of EPA. And when they have public comment periods and public hearings, giving people enough notice and the time that they need to provide those comments, giving power to their voice. And then that's the other piece of that, as you mentioned, with technology, right? There's no reason that, the EPA should not be able to engage folks far and wide who may not be able to show up in person at the meetings to comment on permits to install or air permits or anything else of that sort. I think technology, as you mentioned, has come a long way, and we should use that to be more inclusive of communities and individuals who may not otherwise be able to show up when you need them to show up.
Well, Jerry, the NRDC has done a lot of great work out there, and I appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts and insight with us here on GreenSense.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Jeremy Orr, attorney with a Safe Water Initiative of the Natural Resource Defense Council. You can learn more about their work at nrdc.org. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. And check out the GreenSense Minute every Thursday on News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM, WBBM, Chicago.